Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Laura Stark. I'm associate professor at Vanderbilt University and associate editor of the journal History and Theory. I had the great pleasure of interviewing Rosalind Fredericks about her new book, Garbage Citizenship, Vital Infrastructures of Labor in Dakar, Senegal. The book was published in 2018 by Duke University Press. Fredericks is associate professor of geography and development studies at New York University. I had the great pleasure of interviewing Fredericks along with students in my seminar, History of Global Health. You can find a full list of the students who worked with me on this interview on the website for this episode. I hope you enjoy. Thanks again for making the time to talk with us. And we really enjoyed Garbage Citizenship. The book is looking at infrastructure and especially garbage infrastructure of African, specifically urban environments through the case study of Dakar. And the things that you tell readers about Dakar that are important to know is that it's about 3.5 million people. Senegal itself is about 95% Muslim, so it's a vast Muslim majority, and that it was a former French colony that, like many of the northern Western African countries, gained independence only in the 1960s. So in 1960, in the case of Senegal, is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And then I've often wondered why so much news reporting that I hear from the African continent is out of Dakar. And now this, I've learned so much about the city itself from reading the book, which is that the country and also the city is often considered a real hub of democratic stability, which is why what makes your case so particularly fascinating, because it's something like a best case scenario, and we see the politics and the material politics that unfold. So I want to start off by talking a little bit about your research methods. So you're an ethnographer, and you particularly are what you refer to as a political ethnographer, and you're coming out of the field of geography specifically. And you did field work in Dakar in 2007, 2008. So I wonder if you could just start us off in thinking about questions of infrastructure, materiality, and neoliberalism, which seems to be a key term for the book, whether you could give us a sense of the garbage scapes, the landscapes, the garbage landscapes of Dakar, because so much of the book is about the perceptual feeling of infrastructure.
Absolutely. I mean, when you get off a plane at the airport in Dakar, you're immediately struck by the smell that I have now come to sort of search for and love on some level, which is basically the smell of burning garbage. There are a million different practices of waste management that each and every person is practicing every day. This is a recycling economy, a reuse economy, much like many other economies in the global South, it is an economy where people are sort of toiling and striving and managing their waste at every turn. And part of that is about the sort of incapacity of the state to fully manage it. And part of it is about the sort of need to extract because of, you know, financial pressures, the value out of every possible commodity. So, you know, I think the first thing that's striking to a sort of visitor to Dakar, sort of seeing the wastescape, is just sort of how visual it is, how much it kind of hits you in an olfactory sense right away. It's just very hard to avoid. So the sort of out of sight, out of mind approach to managing waste, which really dominates in much of the world and certainly is a goal in Senegal, is not really in pragmatically kind of in practice there. Waste is everywhere, not, as I'm trying to explain in this book, because people are just careless and litterers or something, but because of this intense politics that revolves around waste management, but also just because of the sort of everydayness of ordinary waste management that everybody practices, especially women, young people, sort of people who are more involved in managing household duties and keeping the sort of domestic sphere clean. So it's hard to avoid. And certainly in the last 10, 20 years of this sticky garbage politics, in Dakar that I'm kind of charting and historicizing, it's been really at the forefront of your kind of urban experience, which is worrisome to the state, worrisome to, you know, those actors that would like to, you know, polish the city into a more modern looking, modern smelling, kind of sanitized urban sphere. But, you know, despite all that, it's there. So that's sort of a sort of beginning sense of what the garbage scape sort of looks like, smells like. And certainly around the strike times, it is really at the forefront of the urban imaginary, the urban experience, because as I describe in the book, the garbage really piles up and blocks traffic and kind of gets in everybody's way and is just screaming to be dealt with. So there's pretty much no way to avoid it. If you have to go to a market, have to drive down the street, you're going to kind of run into this friction, this sticky, messy garbage politics that continues to this day.
Yeah, one of the things that was so enlightening about the book is to be able to see waste as an intentional political practice when it's made and used in public settings, and also bringing back the fact that it's material that can be used and mobilized and enrolled for political purposes. One of the key terms for the book is thinking through neoliberalism, and for a lot of people, that big concept is scary, or else it's something that folks feel like has lost some sort of traction. And what we all really liked about the book is that you're showing how neoliberalism takes multiple forms. So you're helping us see that it indexes something, or some things, and particular in this transition after, or the time period after independence, you nicely sort of capture a shift that otherwise could just be seen as very politically complicated, in which there was sort of socialist efforts that got turned into a devolved, individualized, some would say neoliberalized, ideas about who should be cleaning up the garbage and who should be doing the work of civic care. And this revolves in part around the structural adjustment programs that seems like that seems to be an important part of Senegal's history around 1979 into the 80s. I think you're right, there are more than 15 loans from the IMF and the World Bank captured under structural adjustment. And this is really what points at neoliberalism for you. Could you explain a bit what that big turn was and what it looked like on the ground when there was a move from, or it, many moves in between public, private, municipal, state-centered approaches to infrastructure, private, whether it was domestic or international companies that were doing the work. Could you just talk us through what the turn towards neoliberalism looked like?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the key words, that's helpful to think through sort of neoliberalism with Senegalese characteristics is experimentation. I mean, that I think that incredible institutional instability that really just took on such an incredible range of forms really represents a kind of obviously the outcome of internal struggles within different echelons of the state and different politicians trying to sort of prove, you know, their legacy to their constituents, et cetera. But it really sort of at a more, you know, basic level just represents a kind of incessant experimentation that I think the neoliberal political economic backdrop of structural adjustment and the austerity, all different kinds of austerity policies that it led to has unleashed. You know, it's just these different sort of government agencies and the power, you know, brokers within them, certain personalities emerge here, and the tension between the local and the national state is, of course, very important. Just experimenting, trying to battle through austerity, especially at the urban level, at the same time as modernizing in the image of what this aspiring global city, you know, wants to look like, wants to perform on a sort of global stage. So, you know, I think a quality of that, I mean, there's a real performative quality of that experimentation because it is outward looking, and that's what structural adjustment programs really enforced. You know, it was a kind of outward looking and externalization of the sort of priorities and the performance of urban management, civic care, as you described it, to a kind of international community, to a community, obviously, of international institutions and bankers like IMF and World Bank, but also to the sort of visiting community of tourists, which are now really important to the Senegalese economy now that sort of industry has been quashed, and some of the other more natural resource-based sectors like fishing and mining have declined just because those ecologies have declined. And so tourism is now the number one economic sector. I think it's right behind or sometimes ahead of remittances, which again is an outward looking international diasporic connection. So I think you have to think about austerity in this performance of kind of modernity through a sort of bourgeois environmentalism, you know, in light of this kind of outward looking performance. And I think that Asher Gertner's work on the aesthetics of rule is really important here, of sort of aesthetics of what modernity or modern urban development is supposed to look like. And that toil or laboring bodies, the bodies of cleaning workers in the public space, is a really key piece of performing the modernity of the aspirational city. So I think obviously that gets into what my intervention is, which is really aimed at sort of injecting more of an attention to the bodies of infrastructure into our understanding of how urban infrastructures have been resculpted, reconfigured, experimented around in neoliberal economies in the wake of structural adjustment, And I think that was a bit of a sort of lacuna before myself and some other people have, you know, have taken that up, is thinking about the role of bodies in sort of enacting the politics of austerity, obviously through the work of the state in flexibilizing labor, but then in the work of the social movements in resisting that flexibilization. So.
Okay. Yeah, great. Can you just give us a quick idea of what you mean when you talk about flexibilization of labor, which is coming out of structural adjustment?
Mm-hmm. I mean, at its base, it's about obviously rendering the labor less valuable in the sense that labor is remunerated less than a sort of than certainly the image of the remuneration of labor for the city, municipal labor in the kind of state developmentalist period of the nationalist era in Senegal. So sort of the 60s and the 70s, the kind of golden years of Senegalese development when the state employed a lot of people, did a lot to foster employment and steer the economy. And the way that that has radically shifted to, and that was premised on this vision of sort of full employment and the, you know, fully experience right, yeah, labor rights of a kind of unionized labor force, especially at the municipal level. That was part and parcel of the socialist dream in Senegal. And so that's radically reconfigured under structural adjustment and its wake through these institutional reconfigurations, which basically were premised on devolving the logics of austerity onto labor, meaning downward pressure onto these laboring bodies to do more work with less pay, and importantly, more work with less protections. So we're talking about workers who, at the height of you know, the sort of austerity politics in the garbage sector, were not even provisioned equipment. So they're doing this work with their bare hands, or not provisioned protective clothing, all of that. So there's this sort of flexibilization of the actual labor, the, you know, street labor. But mostly it's about the ability to fire them. And that's what the sort of grab of Sète Sète Tall by the mayor Mamadou Diop was all about in my formulation, was about firing the original trash workers who had been unionized and protected and difficult to fire, and replacing them with contract labor that was seen to be easy to replace. And then, of course, it wasn't easy to replace once they were able to unionize and use the power of garbage through trash strikes to sort of establish their legitimacy and power as a union. So I think flexibilization works on all those different levels. It also is a sort of imaginary of flexibility in the sense that it's about tapping the labor of households. And so this is when we move into really sort of tapping the social reproductive labors of community members as a subsidy to the realm of municipal labor, as a subsidy to the realm of state provision of welfare goods.
It's really helpful. I mean, one of the things that you show really interestingly is how the social movement to rethink responsibility, who or what should be responsible for the care of people, co-opting people who are part of a social movement to become contract workers, and in doing so kind of quash the ability or the motivation to protest, and with that, hiring people as contract workers as one of the strategies that was being used. But you do such really interesting work on the rhetoric of community in particular, and really showing how that captures or does a lot of work in actually perpetuating tremendous, the very injustices that the state is supposed to be wanting to overcome. So I'm actually going to hand it over to Emma to follow up on the issue of community.
So I'm hoping that you might be able to speak a little bit about the dynamic between empowerment and engagement when it comes to community-based initiatives, particularly in reference to YAF in the third chapter, but more broadly speaking, how do those tensions come to play when you're trying to initiate a community-based project?
Mm-hmm. Great. I mean, this chapter and, you know, the sort of wider intervention around YAF and the sort of incorporation of ordinary household members into, you know, as a part of the urban waste infrastructure, as a kind of, you know, key sort of buttress to the municipal trash sector, was really engaging with critical development studies ideas around that are critiquing ideas of empowerment and ideas of community in sort of mainstream development. So that was actually the way that I originally got into this project. I did an earlier project on the politics of eco-sanitation stations in YAF for my master's in 2002. And was just intrigued by the fact that there was all this work that had been written, some of it published, kind of circulating on the internet, you know, touting the key role of communities in doing environmental sustainability work, eco-sanitation work in the periphery of the city. And that when I actually went and talked to people, because I was excited about sort of glorifying these, you know, very positive case studies that I'd read about on the internet. When I went to go talk to people who'd been involved in those projects, they revealed to me that the projects were a resounding failure, no longer existed, and that people felt that they had been really exploited through that. And so there was a real, you know, there was obviously a key contradiction there in the definition of community, the idea of community that was being sort of described in these kind of best practices by the NGOs. Compared that with the actual experience of community and the experience of solidarity, or the opposite of that, the divisions that was introduced by these projects on the ground. And so then that led into this project in chapter 3, where I'm really trying to kind of speak to especially the development studies literature and the development organizations out there that still often deploy a sort of uncritical definition of community and participation that is rooted in often, you know, or that silences the often sort of exploitative relationships between, you know, different community members and the power relations that exist between them under the guise of community. So I think what is revealed there is that empowerment is a really slippery slope, and obviously just the act of participating in a project doesn't automatically mean empowerment. It doesn't automatically lead to empowerment. Empowerment is a much deeper concept, but that needs to be thought of not just in relation to how people are invested in a project, or even in the case of the one that I was looking at, sort of enrolled, conscripted into a project, but more about how these projects then reshape social power dynamics, how they reshape the participants' relationships to their communities, and whether they become empowered vis-a-vis their communities and the power dynamics that they live with every day or not.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and some of the key power differences and imbalances within community that were so unexpected from just reading an NGO literature were especially looking at economic inequality. So basically people who are already in economically precarious positions being the ones called on and then sustained in that economic precarity by doing the sanitation work. And then also how tremendously gendered the concept of community is, as in terms of the valences it has in the NGO literatures, at least. And especially striking was in Senegal, seeing how municipal, quote unquote, housekeeping in terms of gender was really playing out around ideas of responsibility for garbage. And on the issue of gender, Claudia is going to take it over from here.
So as a part of your discussion in Chapter 3 about the Yoff Community Project, you do talk about the role of gender. So could you tell us a bit about the role of women in community and how they are uniquely affected by garbage politics?
Sure. I mean, women really are at the forefront of garbage politics in general, just because they are seen culturally in Senegal as the primary waste managers, as those responsible for waste in the home, because they are responsible for the domestic, they sort of, you know, are seen as managers of the domestic space. And so the way that then interfaces with formal or these community-based waste management projects is that these, you know, supposedly forward-thinking, progressive-minded NGOs wanted to prioritize women's roles in new, supposedly progressive and empowering projects to improve waste management. And first and foremost, this was seen as potentially benefiting women most because they were aimed at improving waste management in a neighborhood that had a lot of problems with waste management because it was very difficult for the trucks to access these communities. So it was seen as a potential benefit to women who were saddled with dealing with these uncollected wastes and obviously sort of disciplined and even criminalized because of the different tactics they had to resort to get rid of their waste and keep their families safe, like dumping in the ocean and burying and dumping in nearby public spaces and ditches and stuff their waste. So bringing them into the project was seen as a way to sort of empower them to have a voice in the system. But what I revealed was that they weren't brought into the design of the project. In fact, they were only brought in this neighborhood case to an exploitative labor arrangement, which was quite stigmatizing because it literally sullied these women who were brought in as participants because they got dirty doing this work door to door with their bare hands for free, basically as volunteers, sort of forced volunteers. And they were sullied in a symbolic sense and in a kind of societal sense because they were stigmatized by becoming these municipal housekeepers. So that was an intensely gendered experience that then bled into the way that gender intersects with these other relationships, ethnicity, because the women that were, conscripted into this work were of a specific ethnicity, and so that the projects were aimed at sort of performing a certain kind of ethnic you know, authority over the other ethnic group present there, the other sort of marginalized ethnic group there, but also in the sense of reorganizing the power or reconfiguring power dynamics between men and women in households, because these projects resculpted the sort of budget, household budgets, the bargaining power of women who were being enlisted in paying more for garbage and paying these new fees. And then, of course, for the participants, for the women who were doing the garbage collection themselves, who were being enlisted as neighborhood workers with no benefits. So for them, it was particularly stressful on their relationships to their partners, to their families, et cetera.
The book makes literal so many of the metaphors that we often hear about in terms of sort of the symbolic value of people, and especially with this book dwelling on disposability. So disposability of what would just conventionally be considered waste, but then disposable lives and what has worth and what has value and who decides. In addition to the gender dimensions of Senegal, one of the distinctive features of the space, the social and physical space, also seems to be the fact that it's a vast Muslim majority country and city. And so here I'm going to hand it over to Haley.
So chapter 4 really describes the Muslim religious connection between waste removal and the value of cleanliness. So I was wondering if it was fair to say that religion is the most dominant form of motivation in garbage collection, and why more people weren't interested in working in this sector if it's seen as such a high religious value.
Great question. I'm not sure I can say it's the most, but I think it is a powerful force shaping the meaning and value of all kinds of cleaning work in the home, acts of reuse and recycling at all scales, and then certainly the municipal work of cleaning. But I think that the trash worker, the municipal trash workers union, was particularly savvy at deploying this idea of cleaning as piety and a practice that they felt brought them closer to God, deploying that on a kind of public level. I think that is generally felt by waste workers, but is not widely recognized, or was not widely recognized by the sort of general population. I think the overpowering abjection that we associate with waste and waste work, it really sits in tension with the fact that cleanliness, cleaning, ablution, purity is so paramount in all religions, but certainly in Islam. So I think that there's a real tension there with the fact that cleaning is generally understood by sort of average Senegalese as important, but that they didn't usually make the leap to say that means garbage collectors' work is valuable and important because of the stigma that comes with waste itself. So the waste dialectic is a complicated, the waste value dialectic is a complicated one that I think expresses itself in very different ways in different contexts. And there's a lot of really interesting work by fellow discardians. This is what waste people who study waste call themselves, or are starting to call themselves. So discardians sort of in context around the world are really trying to expose and unearth the waste value dialectic as it plays out in different contexts. And so I think what I was trying to do in this particular political context was to show the tension between this kind of contradictory relationship between ideas of purity and waste and value with the, you know, very strategic kind of mobilizing of the union. And I do think that that is at the base of how they were able to sort of change public opinion, and certainly to change state opinion about the value of waste work. but the battle has not been won. I think waste workers are still stigmatized. I'm now working on a sort of sequel to this book, working with the informal trash recyclers who work actually at the dump, who are not municipal employees, but are informal recyclers, pickers, reclaimers, and they are particularly stigmatized. So I think that progress has been made, but it hasn't been made so far as to, you know, inciting sort of everybody, you know, especially those who have other options to want to work in the garbage sector. It certainly has incited more to consider it a respectable profession, but there's a lot of work to be done. And we've seen that all across the world. My colleague Robin Nagel has done an ethnography here in New York City of the waste collector, you know, the trash collectors here, the Department of Sanitation in New York, and finds very similar stigmatization, abjection, despite the fact that the workers here are very well paid. They are also unionized, very well protected. It is a good job. And yet they are incredibly stigmatized within the sort of people that they serve.
Mm, yeah. Picking up on your comment that the battle has not been won, it seems to be, as you point out, a battle not only about the issue of infrastructure, but of the promises of social justice on which so many post-colonial countries really hope and turn. And on this issue, Andrew wants to hop in.
So you published this book just over a year ago in September of last year. And I was wondering, since that time, you mentioned about your sequel, but I was wondering about Dakar. What changes have you noticed in that time? And these can be material changes, ideological, political, anything you've seen since you've done your research, and also including your new sequel, if that is relevant.
And you're talking about in the waste sector, or?
Mostly the waste sector, yes. But if there's other areas of socialized or institutionalized infrastructure, that would be interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big question, but these dynamics are absolutely ongoing. In fact, the Trash Workers Union went on strike recently to protest the state's lateness in paying them. I think they were a few months behind in payments. And so there were recently strikes, and they are certainly not happy with, the deal that they've gotten in terms of healthcare and salaries. And it seems as though, even though the city balloons gets bigger and bigger every year, and the waste challenge gets bigger and bigger every year, the sector of well-paid and well-protected trash workers does not go up much. So a lot of contract labor is still being employed in Dakar in the formal trash sector, where the state sort of brings in day laborers to do a cleaning job here and there. And the permanent workers that are unionized are not happy about that. So this continues. There's certainly ongoing dynamics. And one of the major ones is the subject of my second project, which is that there is a massive World Bank loan that the state has engaged into. It also involves funding from the Spanish aid agency and a couple of other aid agencies that is aimed at reconfiguring the disposal system. So not just collection, but the waste dumps and landfills in the country. And a major piece of that, which is the one that I'm looking at, because that is a project that spans the country, but I'm just looking at the sub project aimed at upgrading Dakar's dump. And it's a really interesting proposition, this project, because so for years the state has tried to close Dakar's dump, which is one of the biggest open-air dumps in Africa. It's been there since 1968 and is really a blight on the sort of image of the city in the eyes of the state. And they've tried to close it before and much to their dismay have not been able to because of protests both at the proposed site for the new sanitary landfill, which was sabotaged by a local sort of NIMBY movement, not in my backyard movement, but also by the trash pickers themselves who are organized into an association and have protested the closure of the dump. So what they've decided to do now with the funding of this World Bank loan is to upgrade it, valorize it, leave it there, but change the way it functions, which is a really interesting proposition because this is, you know, very old, very large, stinky dump that works in a certain way according to how the pickers over the last 50 years have developed these recycling niches. There are settlements on the dump. I mean, it is a huge, intricate set of economies, some of which stretch all the way to Asia and the Arab world in terms of recycling networks. That the state is now starting to get involved with and starting to say it's going to valorize. So this is a big hot button issue. There are a lot of major negotiations that are happening now. I am following it very closely. I've been doing ethnography over the last 3 years there and will be writing up a sort of before set of publications that examine the kind of before the upgrade and then watching the upgrade as it happens. But I'm not convinced that the state's claim to valorization and sort of retaining, you know, the picker's rights to the dump will be upheld. So I think there's a lot at stake there. And that has been definitely on the front lines of national policy and urban policy in Senegal. So I think garbage politics remain really important there.
Yeah, one of the...
I hope I've answered your part of your question.
You have. Thank you.
The ongoing sort of nature of both your work and also the politics as they unfold, it seems like one of the real things that we appreciated in the book is that you've been doing work in Senegal for more than a decade now and have multiple projects. We'll look forward to those the write-up of the new project for sure. And you have a position both as an observer, but also as an ally. So as a political ally and the work of social justice for a lot of the people. And so this is an issue that we've talked about quite a bit over the course of the semester. And I think Jesse really sort of crystallized it nicely for us. So I'm going to hand it over to him.
So in the conclusion of your book, you allude to a conversation that you had with Issa Ndoye that you said stuck with you throughout the writing of this project. And so he reminded you to remain diligent when making conclusions and kind of stray away from being prescriptive and instead stay more integrated with the community, within conversations and interactive to see what they think is the best practices. So I was wondering what challenges you found kind of in your role as a researcher and ethnographer and also as a political ally to kind of following this advice and what difficulties you face when kind of keeping that in mind and balancing, you know, what your opinion might be versus what people on the ground think is the best option.
Great question. Yeah, I mean, the sort of ethics of this research, you know, are always at the forefront of my mind and certainly shape the ethnographic experience very deeply. In a certain respect, the project on the municipal trash workers was, my positionality was, you know, not that contentious. They were very excited to share their sort of battle with me, brought me into the inner workings of the union, shared with me the daily practice of their work, and really were just hoping for more visibility. They wanted visibility within the academic realm. That was certainly where I was focusing my efforts was through these academic publications. I also teach a class in Dakar every couple of years with my students from NYU, and invite the leaders of the trash union to give a sort of lecture about their experience and interact and discuss with my students what their experience was like, and they're always very excited about that and amazing to talk to. So those have sort of been the ways that I have engaged with framing this work, and of course discussing my findings with my primary interlocutors in Senegal over and over as they evolved through that project. But none of that was terribly sensitive, in the sense that they were at the forefront of sculpting their message because they had a certain level of visibility. They were very savvy over the airwaves, you know, on TV, et cetera. So I didn't play a role in that. I think it's a bit different for my work at the dump, because the pickers at the dump are so incredibly stigmatized. I mean, they really are very negatively viewed. Many of them hide the fact that they work at the dump from their families, from their partners, from their kids. And so my work with them is much more sensitive, in the sense that, you know, I have to work much more carefully to hide their identities, and very difficult to take images out there. But I have gotten, I also think that they are in a position where they are particularly precarious, and it's become clear to me that I occupy a position of privilege, in the sense that I have access to some of the big players that are shaping their future, access that many of them don't have. So the Pickers Union, or the Pickers Association, leaders are very much in contact with the World Bank and with the state over this upgrade project, but not the sort of everyday ordinary pickers who don't even know a lot of the stuff is happening. And yet I do have contact with the World Bank project managers, with the state managers, the engineers, the city planners who are involved in this. So I've actually started to play a very careful advocacy role through involvement with an NGO that works out at the dump to promote and protect pickers' labor rights. And it's a Senegalese NGO that has an international sort of connection to it, but that is run by a Senegalese jurist, a lawyer who has expertise at the dump and in these legal issues around labor rights and the rights of informal workers in particular. So I have sort of cautiously and carefully started a line of communication with this NGO. And my master's student, who's working with me at the dump, is an intern with them and did a few month internship with them. So we've got a kind of open line of communication. It's unclear exactly where that's going to go, but I certainly hope that the research that we're doing at the dump does have a positive impact on the rights of the workers, because that is where my priorities are. In any way that we can, but treading very carefully, knowing that all of the information that we gather at the dump is potentially volatile and could potentially come down on, you know, certain individuals in a negative way. We are strategizing to positively impact the upgrade process and inform the process through the ethnographic work, to make sure that a good understanding of the value of these economies, the values of these labors, the individual sort of vulnerabilities, especially if particular populations present on the dump and gender is really important there, that those are taken into account. And I've just heard that some of this pressure has led to the World Bank asking for a livelihood survey and plan, which is World Bank talk for deeper research on their side into the potential impacts of the upgrade, which I think means that the advocacy work of the NGO, is is working, you know, to at least put some pressure on the bank to be more careful and more sensitive to the impacts that it could have, and to design the upgrade project in a way that privileges the laborers that are already working and have been working for 50 years on the dump. So let's hope that is the case.
Yeah, on the key term of hope, it's we really appreciate being able to sort of see the spots to amplify and to work towards and find hope in this kind of research context. You've been so generous with your time with us. There's so many things we didn't get to talk about, but one of the things that you really helped us see in particular is that it's not a question of bodies and infrastructure in thinking about things like the global South, questions of political history, but instead of bodies and infrastructure, but starting just to see bodies as infrastructure and issues of labor and affect, all these things we'd love to talk with you more about, but we want to let you go and just hope that listeners will pick up the book and also see all the amazing images that you collected as well. It's really just a tremendous, labor on your part of gathering all the images that are really remarkable for the book. So thank you so much for your time and also for this incredible book.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation. It was great to talk to you.